This is episode 181, recorded October 7th, 2013.
Greetings, Aquariumaxers.
Hello, hello. I don't have language today. I'm sorry. I'm unprepared linguistically.
No, I think you'll be fine.
So I'll just say hi.
But we have some happy news.
We do.
Do you remember when it was Tom in Provo said, why don't you guys have a donation button on your page? That would be really useful, and there would be people who would donate.
And we said, you, sir, are a genius.
So, we put one on the page last week on Wednesday.
And somebody used it.
Yeah. We hadn't even announced it on the page.
Yeah, they just found it.
Yeah, so we got a donation.
That was kind of exciting.
Yeah. So, we would like to officially announce the donation button on our webpage. Just go to aquariumaxers.com, scroll down to the bottom of the main page, and there's a little donation button there.
And we will be saving up for a field recorder and such audio equipment as will enhance your listening experience.
Yeah. So we're also going to put on some kind of status bar every episode. We'll give some sort of information. Right now, we're up to $25, thanks to our generous donator. And I'm just going to say his name.
Because he's the first.
I'm not going to say his last name, just in case he doesn't want to, you know, be identified. But his name is Steve. So thank you, Steve. That was really awesome.
That's pretty awesome.
I'm not going to, I don't want to dissuade anyone or discourage anyone from donating because they don't want to hear their name, so... If you
but
donate,
that was like the first one. So,
yeah, and nobody knows whether he's, you know, Steve in Australia or Steve in the Dominican Republic or Steve in...
Iceland.
Nobody knows, so it's okay. I didn't reveal anything secretive about him. And just for the record, it wasn't any of those three places. But I thought that was really great that he found that on his own initiative and did that. So we would like to encourage you to join along with Steve if you'd like to, so that we can get a field recorder. We're having the darndest time recording from our new computer.
Yeah, and I don't know, the mics aren't working right, so we're actually just both using one mic tonight instead of each of us having our own.
Because apparently this computer can't power two of them, and a field recorder would resolve that problem too. So
plus we could go out and do interviews with people in the field.
Yeah.
So we could record them.
In the field. And that sound of...
You know, in the tank.
Susan over there, who is picking up bits of gravel and spitting them back out and making those little jiggly noises that you can probably hear.
The ambient fish noises.
Those wouldn't be happening either. Yeah. So, you might get some gecko chirping.
When my rocking chair squeaks, maybe you wouldn't hear that either.
Yeah. So, that's where we are, but we'd like to thank you again, Steve, for doing that. Thank you, Tom, for the idea, and hopefully you'll join in. Those of you who feel so inclined will join in so that we can improve our audio situation.
Okay. And with that, we will get started.
Yes, let us begin.
We are going to hear from Dr. Bob in Boston today. The North Shore of Boston, I might add. Yes, and he has a question.
Okay.
He says, can the nitrifying bacteria from a saltwater aquarium filter medium be used to start the nitrification cycle in a freshwater aquarium? And how about the other way around?
Okay, well, you know, when he said that, I wasn't quite sure. I had the sort of feeling that it wasn't, but I wasn't sure, and I looked up a few things. And apparently, some research has been done on that, and though the bacteria are related... There are some from the same genera that do that. There's at least one genus, Nitrosococcus, that works in saltwater but not in freshwater. And apparently, even if you put freshwater Nitrosomonas or Nitrobacter in saltwater, it doesn't work very well.
Hmm.
So
are they just not salt tolerant?
I guess not. At least they don't function as well. Hmm. So although you could put bacteria of one type or another in, and you'd eventually get a cycling tank, that's only because the other ones would eventually colonize it anyway.
It wouldn't have anything to do with the original ones you put in.
Except perhaps as something to decay and produce ammonia as a food source. So, yeah, apparently it doesn't work. And thank you to Dr. Bob, because I learned something about that So that spurred my curiosity and helped us figure that out.
Interesting. Okay, so who do we have next?
Next is Tom in Provo.
Sorry, I was trying to find it on my notes.
Tom in Provo, Utah.
Okay, he says, in for a penny, in for a pound. The pH controller to go with my pressurized CO2 system arrived today.
Yay!
Which we were talking about last week.
Yes.
But while waiting for it, I continued to research and repeatedly read that a good planted tank requires a harmonious balance of substrate, fertilizers, and CO2. But I have a non-nutritive gravel substrate. I kept telling myself that I could get away with that as long as the fish and I provided enough fertilizer and I selected the right plants. But I knew I would ultimately be frustrated if I were limited to certain plants. At this point, it's crazy not to upgrade to an enriched substrate as well. Better now than after the plants become established. Any suggestions for substrate? EcoComplete? Something else?
Well, kudos to you for thinking ahead, because you will want an enriched substrate at some point. I'm sure. Because it is possible to grow plants in a non-enriched substrate, but it is tricky. And it's just not as fun. It's not as easy. It's harder to balance nutrients, mm-hmm. especially trace elements and things like that. So, that's a good move. I would say, I gave him some suggestions, actually, via email, but I would say that, personally, I prefer fluorite. Not because I think there are any problems with some of the others out there, but I like it because it's available, and I like what it looks like.
Like it's easy to get a hold of?
It's easy to get a hold of. Like in Hawaii, we could get a hold of fluorite. That was the only enriched substrate that I could easily find.
Mm.
Well, besides
laterite.
I don't know. That's a good question. That may be a Hawaii thing. I don't know. There were a lot of things that weren't available there. But I like the fact that it's available in different shapes and sizes and colors. Like you can get fluorite black. You can get fluorite black sand. You can get fluorite red. You can get the original, you know, sort of clay-y color. It's
so you can kind of match it with your decor.
Mm-hmm. And he said he's going to put his CO2 on hold until he upgrades the substrate, and was glad that Cyberpete had asked about it, and that Mick suggested the proper device for scooping out old gravel. And
I think I remember that.
Yeah, since he has Java fern and Anubias growing on rocks, he can remove those from the tank. That's most of his plants right there, mm-hmm. and that makes it easy. And he's going to report on his successes or whatever else may occur as it goes along. And if Cyberpete or any other Aquarimaxers have already changed substrate, he'd be glad for additional tips and warnings. Okay. And the fish is with me, is what he says.
That's good. So, as far as you just like fluorite just because it's easier to find?
Easier to find. I like the fact that it's available in different shapes and colors.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And particle sizes.
Alrighty. There we go.
And he answered back.
Oh, okay, and he says...
I showed him a quick email, yeah.
Because you were asking about his current substrate.
Mm-hmm.
He says it is pea-sized natural gravel. Can I use that on top of the fluorite? Or would it be better to get something a little smaller? For that matter, do I need anything on top? And he says, by the way, I'm looking forward to a beautiful, lush-planted tank, but secondarily, I love having gadgets like the pH controller to fiddle with.
Well, fluorite is intended to be used alone, but you can use it with other things, but you don't need to. I mean, you can use it perfectly well alone. Laterite you need to put stuff on top of, but that's the only like commercially available substrate I can think of that
has
needs
something on top of it.
Right. And
but it's okay to put something on top of it.
You can, but for best results I think it's recommended you just use it alone. I have a tank or two where I've used it in combination with other things.
Okay.
Right now our tank upstairs with the little catfish and all this stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. It's got black fluorite with some black gravel on the top.
Mm.
For okay. depth. And that works fine.
Okay.
But it doesn't need to be that way. And I totally get the gadget thing. That is fun. It's secondary, but it's fun.
Yes, gadgets are fun. You have something to tinker with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have a new contributor, yes?
Yes, we do.
This is John in Illinois. I don't know that we've ever had anybody from Illinois before, have we?
I'm not sure, but we haven't had John from Illinois. So welcome as an Aquarimaxer.
Yes. He says, I recently found your podcast, and I want to thank you because you are producing a terrific show. It's informative, entertaining, and importantly suitable for all levels of aquarium hobbyists. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You mentioned a few podcasts for aquarium hobbyists and asked if anyone knew of others. One other that you might find interesting is Aquarimania. It is on Pet Life Radio.
Aquarimania.
That's hard to say. Aquarium.
Oh, come on. It's fun to say.
Well... Okay, this is your quote of the show. Many things
on Marva are fun to say.
And your wife sometimes forgets that she is not
a space alien. Okay.
And if you know what that is from, then you should write in because you'll get points. Yeah. I don't know what you're going to do with the points that I keep giving away, but you'll get them. You can hoard them away in your sock drawer until I come up with some prizes.
Okay.
Okay. The host is Dr. Roy from the Florida Aquarium. It covers both fresh and saltwater topics.
And actually, we mentioned that last week because someone mentioned that. Yeah, and that is a good podcast. I do listen to it, and I do recommend it. So we might as well plug it again.
There you go. He says, I have been a hobbyist for many years and have recently become involved with the Chicago Live Bearer Society, and I've started keeping wild live bears. So
that's cool, too.
Welcome, John.
I've dabbled just a wee bit in wild live bears. It's a fun place to go. So we hope to hear from you soon with some of your wild live-bearing adventures.
Okay.
Kelly just gave me a funny look. I knew you were going to give me a funny look, which is why I said it, but that's okay.
Okay, and we have Mike in Savannah, Georgia, right?
Yep.
Is that new too? We've heard from Mike
before,
right?
We've heard from Mike recently, yeah.
Okay. He says, can you talk about making your own fish food, the benefits, drawbacks, and possible health concerns for your fish?
That's a great topic.
A slightly off topic, we used to feed our dog not dog food.
Alternative raw diet.
Yeah, just like actual dog diet. So it was raw meat and raw bones with a little bit of things like flaxseed oil and
broccoli
and stuff. But it was really fun to watch her eat
because she liked it.
Just get it in her back teeth and just arr, 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 arr. It was fun.
Fish don't usually do quite the same.
No, it's not quite this. No.
No, but that's okay. Well, let's talk about that. It's a great topic, Mike. And gel food. Let's talk about gel food because I think when people make their own food, a lot of times that's what they're talking about.
Okay.
Some kind of gel food.
Do you put it in like gelatin or something?
Yes.
It's like Jello for fish.
Yeah, yeah. That's basically what it is. It's a mix of food items, so it's not just Jello. You know, of course, you put veggies, you put shrimp, you put vitamins, all kinds of things in.
But it's all in like this gelatin. Do you blend everything together,
yes.
Or is it chunky Jello? It's like Jello with carrots and raisins in it.
No, most recipes require you to blend it up in a blender.
Okay.
Yes, and then you add.
I would imagine that would be a dedicated blender.
Yeah, I was going to address
that. Not
the
blender that you make your smoothies in.
No, I was going to address that because that comes in the disadvantages. Okay, but yeah, basically people take veggies and in the veggies they'll get like a lettuce kind of thing, you know, some sort of leafy green, mm-hmm. or more than one, like spinach and some lettuce, maybe romaine lettuce and spinach, and maybe it's a little parsley, different things like that. Mm-hmm. They'll put those together and then they'll put some things like red peppers, not the spicy ones so much.
Is that for color?
Like the bell peppers, yeah.
Okay.
And then they'll put shrimp or other things like that for protein, and then they'll throw vitamin and mineral supplements in sometimes. And once they blend it up, then they'll add it to the heated gelatin mixture where you get the water boiling, you know, follow just the plain gelatin recipe and then dump that in. Pour it into an ice cube tray and then freeze it. And then they'll drop one of those ice cubes
into
your food. Uh-huh. And because it's got the gelatin, it kind of holds together.
Well, that's kind of cool.
And so there are several benefits to that.
You could make organic fish food. You could.
That's one of the benefits down here. You control the ingredients. Mm-hmm. And so you can make organic fish food if you want to. You can make food for specific species and purposes. Like, you want to do something that works on color enhancement, you can add ingredients like spirulina that will help with that. If you want to do... You want to keep certain preservatives out of the food, or you want to use different binders, or, you know, things like that. You can do that, because a lot of the binders in dry foods are like wheat flour.
I was just going to say, if you have gluten intolerant fish.
I don't know if they have gluten intolerant fish or not, but
I bet they're developing them if they're putting this fish food.
Who knows?
But we wouldn't know because the fish can't look at you and say, my tummy hurts.
Yeah, but they can get sick.
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, fish are less likely to bloat on this kind of food because it's not dry,
it
and so
fillers.
It doesn't swell up after they eat it, and they don't swallow a whole bunch of bubbles and things like that. And the fish graze on it more naturally. You know, they're eating a little bit at a time. They're picking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And
instead of swallowing a whole big chunk at once.
Right, and they're prepared foods. I can't even talk. Prepared foods that kind of go that direction too, like some of the algae chips and so on are based with the purpose of doing that. What was that?
The
break. Okay. So you tell us.
Okay,
the break stuff.
I'm making up a break thing right now, so it's not really break, but that's okay. The music's playing. If you would like to contribute to Aquarimax attaining a field recorder and other similar
accoutrements, that's a good word,
to enhance your listening pleasure of our show, you can visit aquarimax.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the page and click the donation button. We accept donations from guppy size to arowana size.
That's pretty good.
That's a pretty good, we're good
pretty
break
much right on
plug,
that.
Right? We're almost done. Okay, we're back.
Okay. That worked. That was good. So as I was saying before, you know, there are prepared foods that cater to this fishy, grazy
tendency. I like that. That's
the
crazy
tendency of fish
grazing
to graze. But they, this is kind of going that direction too. So those are some of the benefits. Some drawbacks are that it can be time-consuming to make it. It can be costly too.
Depending
sometimes
you
don't
you
save money, depending on the ingredients you use and so on. It can be messy. It almost invariably is messy to some degree. It can be messy in the tank too. Mm-hmm. When you make it, I mean, when the fish are eating it, although different recipes, you know, are different messy to varying degrees, and you probably do need a dedicated blender, which happily can often be a cheap secondhand one.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a big fancy one.
Right, or see, you go buy a big fancy blender and you say, here's a new fancy blender, can I have this old one? Or something, I don't know.
There you go.
And then, so those are some of the drawbacks. There are some health concerns to think about too. One is, can you make a balanced diet? I mean, most of the people who are making fish food have been doing it professionally for a long time, and they have a long and glorious tradition of, you know, supplementation and knowing what works and of lab tests and so on. So you don't always know that you're going to get a balanced food. Another issue is that if you go, some of the recipes online call for going to buy like a flat of mysis shrimp, okay, frozen from the pet store, throwing them into the blender, blending them up, and allowing them to thaw when you make this mix, and then you're going to refreeze them. Some of them call for that.
That can be dangerous.
That can be bad on several levels. One of them, because frozen food you buy from the store is flash frozen. It freezes very quickly, and the ice crystals are very, very small and tend not to puncture the cell membranes and or cell walls of the food, depending on what you're freezing. So when it is thawed, it tends to be very similar in, you know, consistency,
texture,
appearance, and nutrition to the original food. However, when you freeze it in your own freezer, it freezes at a much higher temperature and much more slowly in your home freezer. Mm-hmm. And so the ice crystals are larger, and they tend to puncture the cell walls and or cell membranes. Therefore, you get leakage on the cellular level, and it turns into mush if you thaw it again to some degree.
So, which is why it makes a big mess in your tank?
Which can end up, you know, it gets leaky in the water, and the fish get fewer of the nutrients, and the water does, and you don't want the water to get the nutrients,
right,
because then bacteria get the nutrients, not the fish.
Well, and there's also the thing, too, if you're buying, you know, meat products, I don't know how, I mean, they're teeny tiny shrimp, but still, they're frozen, and then you thaw them, and then you refreeze them. It can have bacterial issues.
Right, that's another one I got down here. Bacterial contamination is more likely because you're heating something and cooling it, or you're thawing something and refreezing it. That's always a possibility. And
I suppose you could conceivably make the gel food just the veggies and then just throw the frozen shrimp in there like you would feed them to them normally if you were feeding them.
Right, and that's a good point to bring up. I'm glad you brought that up. And, you know, I'll tell you about gel foods. I've done it with good results. There are a lot of people who swear by it and would not go back to anything else, and they do their fish do well. So these are just potential drawbacks, you know, out there. But hopefully that's kind of a look at it. And if any of you Aquarimaxers out there have anything you'd like to add, please do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Alrighty. So now we have Aram in Staten Island, who I think we have heard from before, but it's been a while.
We have heard from him before, yes.
And he says, I have a question about Daphnia. 2 weeks ago, I received a small portion of Daphnia, and I placed them in a 5-gallon bucket with aquarium water. I fed them with some spirulina powder and yeast. From your previous shows, I got a very good tip on what to use to feed the Daphnia culture, so I will modify my recipe slightly very soon. Here are my questions. When do you move the culture indoors?
Okay, let's start with that one.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Around here, I usually move them indoors in October because we start getting our first hard freezes in mid-October. So I usually do it before that.
Okay. That's going to depend on where you live.
Right. In some places, it won't matter. You can keep them out year all outside mm-hmm. year-round. And in other places, you might have to do it earlier. So just, mm-hmm. I would say before your first hard freeze.
Okay. What's the lowest temperature that Daphnia can resist?
Well, I have had, on occasion, when we've had unseasonable freezing, which we do all the time, unfortunately.
Yeah, because Utah doesn't pay attention to things like seasons taking turns.
Right. You get 3 months of summer and 8 months of winter and then whatever else is left. And there isn't anything left because that's
about
13 months
or something. 2 weeks of spring and 2 weeks of fall. And winter comes back and bites you in the butt in June just to remind you that it's still there.
Yeah. Sorry, my math's not very good right now because I haven't been thinking clearly all day, but
you have a headache.
It's okay. That's fine. But where were we? We're talking about
lowest temperature. Lowest temperature.
They froze. I had
the water
ice.
Froze?
I had a thin skin of ice on top of the buckets a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
No Daphnia deaths. They were fine.
You have a really hardy strain.
I do, and it bears mentioning that I do. And my strain might be totally different from yours. There are many strains out there. And they all have different tendencies and different tolerances. But I'm just telling you what I've, mm-hmm. my experience with this particular strain.
Mm-hmm. This is when you keep Daphnia indoors, do you have light on for 24 hours? And if yes, why is it necessary?
I don't. I don't think it's particularly good for them, although it can be done and people do it. I don't. I turn it off at night, and then during the day, I have it go off periodically for an hour or two once in a while. So
why do people keep it on all the time?
I think It will keep them active and feeding more, mm-hmm. and so you might get higher production. But to
that's
me, I just wonder
nice,
if it kind of tires them out.
Yeah.
I don't know. It may not.
I think that sounds very tiring. You never have a rest period.
I noticed that
if they were out in a pond or in a puddle, the sun would go down and they would have a rest period.
And that's my thinking. So I do turn it off at night, and I do turn it off periodically during the day, and they do fine. So there you go.
You get lots of Daphnia.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So hopefully that helps.
Yeah, those are good questions. So yeah, we hope that you have Daphnia success.
Thank you for writing in. Okie dokie, now we have a Sean.
Sean in North Carolina.
Sean in North Carolina. Okay. And he actually brought up a good little helpful technical question. He said, I didn't know if you needed a special word in the subject line, so you didn't toss the message, so I put one in there. So we had never really talked about that when people write in
right.
emails.
And most of them do get tagged with a Querimax automatically because of the way I've got the addresses routed. But it doesn't hurt to put something about a Querimax in the subject line just in case.
Mm-hmm.
Because I fear that once in a while we miss messages, which we don't do on purpose, but it does happen, I'm sure. So mm-hmm.
things get lost in cyberspace or
and
misfiled.
And I might look over it, overlook it by accident. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's happened in the past. So it's good to do that if you are concerned about it. Just put a Querimax in the subject line. That should help.
So now, what had we been talking to Sean about?
About worms. About Walter worms and cultures and too much CO2 and too much yeast causing too much CO2.
Okay. So he says, your advice worked on the worms. Less yeast gets it done. I'm about to start another culture this morning and we'll try it with additional yeast. I'm quite sure it will work.
That's good that it's been helping.
Hmm. It says, the Daphnia died out before I had a chance to pay sufficient attention to them. They were actually Pulex?
Yep, that's the species name.
Okay. I do have a tank of green water now that I'm sure they'd love. I was also using a 10-gallon tank for them and had read in a couple of places that at least 20 gallons would be better. It will probably be a while before I give it another go.
You know, I think we missed an email here.
Yeah.
Because I don't recall having conversed with him about Daphnia. So that is something, I'm glad he brought it up.
He says, I'm going to clean the tank out and reuse it as a quarantine tank. I'm planning to get some angelfish this weekend, pterophyllum. My plan is to add young angels to a 75-gallon community heavily planted tank with various tetras and rasboras. I've tried this before in a 29-gallon, not very well planted tank long ago, and it didn't work very well. Angels ate the tetras eventually. I'm hoping the larger tank with plenty of plants will go better. We'll see.
Yeah, it might go a little better, but my guess is that you'll get predation, some predation anyway. in that tank, just because angelfish are...
That's what they do.
...predators of little fish, and so who knows how it'll go. But I'm guessing you will end up with fewer tetras and reservoirs than you start with.
And he says, I have another question for you guys. The 75-gallon tank mentioned above is attempting to be a Diana Wallstad dirt tank, loosely based on her ecology of the planted aquarium. Substrate is around an inch of topsoil covered with pool sand. This is working well in a few other smaller aquariums around the house. Plants grow great after a few months of settling in. The problem I'm having with this tank is it's got a perpetual haze. I'm pretty sure it's from the corys that he's got Corydoras palaeatus.
Palaeatus is what most people say.
Okay.
I think.
Rooting around. This is the first time ever, can you believe, over 30 years and I've never had a cory? It's been up for months now and is well cycled. I wish I had a microscope so I could confirm what's actually in suspension, but I don't at the moment. But I am considering it for multiple uses. I'm running a Magnum 350 with micron filter on it in an attempt to get all the haze, but it's not happening. I wish I had a DE filter like back in the days. I feel pretty certain it would do the job. So, wondering if you have any potential solutions. I'm even starting to think about rebuilding the whole thing, even though the corkscrew valve is starting to take off finally. I think my main mistake was not rinsing the sand. It wasn't an issue in tanks without a substrate disturber.
That is a tough one. You know, a diatomaceous earth filter, like you mentioned, that probably would do it. It would polish the stuff out.
A diatomaceous earth filter?
Well...
You'll notice I just said DE because I didn't know what it stood
for. No, that's fine. That's fine. Do you know what diatomaceous earth is? Have we talked about that?
I know you've explained it to me before, but I don't remember.
Okay. Basically, diatoms are little algae-like creatures live in the ocean, right? Single-celled little creatures. They build a little tiny, tiny skeleton of silica.
Okay.
So they're basically, it's like glass, sort of. They build these little skeletons, and the skeletons fall down, and there are deposits of them that can be collected. I guess it's a type of fossil anyway, because it's the remains of their, you know, their body parts. That kuma is a very fine material; it's a powder. Because they're so teeny, and on a micro level, it's sharp, really sharp, and you can actually use it to kill bugs. You can sprinkle it around where there are ants or roaches or whatever, and it slices them up. It pokes holes in their breathing, their sphericals. It makes it difficult for them to breathe, and it kind of dehydrates them because they get punctured with this stuff on a really micro level. Anyway, it makes a great filter material in the sense that it can filter very small particles out. Of course, it gets clogged like anything super fast. But back in the day, it was easier to... They would have these diatomaceous earth filters, and they would call them, like, water polishers. Because when you run water through that, it comes out crystal clear. You need to run it through a pre-filter first, because it gets clogged so fast. But once you get all the larger particles out, then you run it through this diatomaceous earth filter periodically. Really cleans out the water.
Wow.
And they've kind of fallen out of favor.
Because they get clogged so fast?
I guess so, but they're really good for that polishing effect. So, yeah, I wonder if they have do-it-yourself ones, plans for them online. That would be my suggestion.
How would you get a hold of the diatomaceous earth?
It's not hard to get a hold of because it's used for a lot of things.
And stuff,
it's used as a polishing agent. It's used for pesticide. You know, it's a non-chemical pesticide. It's like a mechanical pesticide, sort of. So you can get a hold of it. I wonder if they have plans for that. It might be interesting. But I'm kind of going with you that it could be the corys. Remember the time
we had stuff up?
The coolie loaches in with the moon sand, the Tahitian moon sand? They kicked up a mess in there, and I could not do anything about it.
Because they were just throwing it up in the air all the time.
So I eventually just removed that sand because
like
the sand was the issue.
A continuous aquatic pillow fight with feathers in the air.
Yeah, and you put it in gravel and they're fine. But on that sand, it just didn't work. So I'm kind of going with you. I think that it is the fact that they're on a substrate that they can disturb, and the corys are kicking around and disturbing it. So I guess you could move the corys to something else. Mm-hmm. That'd be kind of sad, but that would be one possibility too.
Alrighty, we've still got Matt in Perth. And he says, so sadly today I lost a silver or bala shark. He had been swimming at 45 degrees away from the horizontal for a few days, so it looked like he was looking at the ceiling. The ventral side under his stomach was red and tearing open in small patches. I took him to the local aquarium shop, and unfortunately, during the analysis by the local fish experts, he died in the bucket. I suspect his immune system was highly stressed already, and his body couldn't take the stress of being caught. Although it is callous, I normally let them die. I will separate them if the other fish are picking on them, but it is not easy to diagnose fish diseases, and vets are expensive, and most vets don't do fish anyways.
Right, you can find them, but they are few and far between still these days.
Expensive.
Yes, that's true. And diagnosing fish disease is not always that easy. Mm-hmm. That's very true, too.
So my questions are, what is your fish triage procedure? You have a hospital tank, fish disease book, and a series of medications. How do you dispose of the body? I flush it down the toilet. I would prefer to bury them, but in the past, local cats dig them up and eat them.
I'll tell you what. In the past, probably, I don't know how many years, a number of years, the only two fish diseases I've had serious problems with are ick, which I guess it's not serious problems, but I've had a couple of outbreaks, and then piscine tuberculosis, fish TB,
the mycobacterium.
Mycobacteriosis. And with the ick, it's usually the case of a tank being attacked, a whole tank is attacked with improper quarantine procedures, which is probably why I've only had a couple of outbreaks in the past X number of years, 10 years, whatever it is. So, this is what I've done. I just treat the ick in the tank by raising the temperature.
Did you put some salt into, or was that something
else? I usually don't do that.
Okay, just the temperature?
Yep, usually just the temperature, and that usually takes care of it. Depends on the fish, because different fish can handle different things, but like with angelfish, I'll go like to 88.
Because they're happy with that.
Mm-hmm. But ick is not happy with that. And it usually takes care of it.
What does it have to at least get to kill the ick?
Well, it starts interfering with the reproductive capacity of ick at around, I think it's 86.
So and it has to at least get to 86.
Probably has to get to about there to be really effective, yeah.
Okay.
And with the other disease, I've had issues with the mycobacteriosis, like I said. Once a fish exhibit symptoms, I don't waste any time. I euthanize
There's
it.
There's not really anything
There's
you can do.
There's nothing you can do by the time it's really symptomatic. So I just euthanize it. I isolate it from the other fish and euthanize it.
Which usually you use the clove oil.
Yes, I usually use the clove oil. The other fish diseases, there have been occasions where I do isolate a fish in a hospital tank. It's always good to have a hospital tank around. Isolate it and see what I can do with it, but
we tried that with Gwen's goldfish.
Apple fishy. Yeah.
Because he was her goldfish. She got him for her second birthday.
And we were trying to do everything we could, but mm-hmm. he...
It was just the mycobacterium.
Yeah, we figured that's what it probably was. But we tried it anyway. We did everything we could for him. Tried several medicines and so on, but you can't do much. But we wanted Gwen to know that we were doing what we could.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it went with that one. But hasn't been much of a problem recently.
What about injuries? If they have an injury, would you recommend moving them to a hospital tank, or is that just going to stress them out more?
It depends on the situation, how the gravity of the injury, you know. Mm-hmm. I've had fish who heal perfectly well in a tank with all the other fish if they're otherwise healthy. But if it's something that's impairing them, making it difficult
from
for them
eating.
To swim or to eat or to see, then I would recommend moving them, yeah.
Okay.
And of course, most diseases, if you see a fish that's acting sick and the other fish aren't, it's always a good idea to isolate it.
So they don't get sick.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, how do you dispose of the body?
Okay, well, and he mentions flushing it down the toilet, and actually I don't like to do that, especially with mycobacteriosis, because that kind of bacterium can survive fairly well in the whole chlorination procedure. They can end up in coming out of someone's sink.
Which would be bad.
Kind of scary, because they're resistant to so many things.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually recommend wrapping them up and throwing them away.
In the garbage.
So,
like, don't bury them.
Don't bury them, don't flush them down the toilet, wrapping them up thoroughly and putting them in the garbage.
In a plastic bag?
Well,
or a sandwich bag? Or
paper is good.
Paper,
several layers of
paper.
Okay. And then, because that's biodegradable eventually,
Okay.
It breaks down. So that would be what I would suggest, because you don't want the cats digging them up and eating them, like he mentions when he tries to bury them. We sometimes bury ours outside.
The kids, goldfish and stuff.
But typically when we do, we put them under a large rock so that nothing can dig them up. So that's a couple of ideas.
Okay, so hopefully that's helpful, Matt.
Yeah. And you know what? We're just about ending. We're to ending point. So why don't we do this? Dr. Bub has a lot of great stuff.
Yeah, it's a nice long one.
So let's save that for the next show, because we've already gone a bit over this week. We'll save it for the next show, and we'll probably get some other submissions too, and we'll have a great show ready to go.
In the meantime,
may the fish
be with you.